Even a global crisis can provide opportunities for fairer, freer, and better ways of organizing our world. But too often, they can simply become moments to further entrench power, hegemony, and undue influence. Unfortunately, as history has demonstrated, global policymaking is often shifted in undesirable directions because those in power use crises to push their own interests. Some commentators have made comparisons between the global impact of 9/11 on public policy and the impact of the COVID-19 virus, because while the COVID pandemic may be over, just like 9/11, its impacts still reverberate. And they're likely going to stay with us for some time to come. COVID-19 had a fundamental impact on our economies, on global governance, and global policymaking. Through a series of interviews with experts in their respective fields, TNI associate Arun Kundnani set out to explore all the different facets of the pandemic's impacts, from the growing role of major pharmaceutical corporations in global healthcare, to the response of global governance bodies such as the World Health Organization and the United Nations, to the part played by big tech companies, and the impact on global debt and on migration and race politics. I had a chance to sit with them and explore his findings and to see what alternatives are available for us when the next crisis comes rolling in, something which is all but inevitable. Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I'm your host, Sean Macheza. Our guest today, Arun Kundnani, is a TNI associate and author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. He's also recently released a new book, which is called What is Anti-Racism and Why It Means Anti-Capitalism? I highly recommend it. I began by asking Arun what led him to take on the task of holding this series of conversations.
Yeah, thank you for having me. So, you know, I've done work over the last couple of decades, really, looking at, and one of the things I've been looking at is the war on terror and the kind of way that anti-Muslim racism kind of intensified in the kind of post 9/11 period and the kind of processes of securitization that were bound up with that and the rights violations that resulted in. And, you know, the beginning of 2020, when it became apparent that there was going to be this kind of global health emergency, you know, one of the things that I was interested in is what would be the politics of that? How would that look in terms of, would it be a similar kind of process to what we saw after 9/11 of this kind of process of securitization around health this time, with all kinds of dangers in terms of particular communities being targeted or the use of a state of emergency to suspend rights, to clamp down on protests, to clamp down on marginalized groups and that kind of thing. And, you know, at this time, President Trump was in the White House in the United States. There was a number of other authoritarian leaders around the world. You could see that if they were inclined to do so, they had the opportunity with this kind of global emergency to intensify a kind of authoritarianism.
Like to not waste a crisis, as it were.
Exactly. And so my idea was to try and think about how to track that. And I came up with this idea of doing a series of interviews with people who I thought might have interesting insights on that question. I was a newbie to the question of thinking about the politics of health and the politics of pandemics. So I thought I should talk to people who might know more about that than me to try and think this through. And so I planned a series of 10 interviews to explore those questions.
Uh-huh, great. And so you started out looking at essentially the COVID crisis in particular and its impact on securitization. But looking at the whole series of interviews, would you say you found out stuff you didn't initially think you would find? What were kind of the main highlights that you came across?
Well, you know, there were examples where it did look quite like how I expected it to, based on the analogy with the war on terror. So, you know, for example, in December 2021, I interviewed Eda Sehan, who's an international human rights lawyer and researcher who focuses on policing and national security and racial justice. And she talked about how there has been this dramatic expansion of state powers during the pandemic, and that has been used as a pretext to target all kinds of marginalized groups, migrants, refugees, precarious workers, protesters, racialized groups. 170 countries declared states of emergency. You know, we saw public assembly being made unlawful, restrictions on press freedom, border controls, suspension in some places of electoral or legal processes. We saw an increased police violence, especially directed at racialized groups, migrant workers, and so on. And so, you know, that story was definitely there. Even I would say there was a desire, even on the part of some liberals, to kind of call for the state to be even tougher, you know, in imposing lockdowns, in kind of enforcing vaccines. And it became quite hard to talk about some of that in 2021, especially when you had this kind of conservative kind of anti-lockdown, anti-vax movement, and the left didn't really, it was kind of ambiguous or reluctant even to talk about the question of policing of, you know, during the pandemic, because it seemed like this would play into the kind of conservative anti-lockdown movement. But, you know, and this is an argument that Edda Sayan made. It was a mistake, really, for the left to, or for liberals to not take up those issues. And often they were hidden, you know, like you didn't see, you know, like governments kind of declaring states of emergency and completely suspending democracy, you know, in a kind of classic kind of idea of a kind of coup in a state of emergency and the suspension of democracy. But you did, you know, for, I think particularly for groups like migrants, for example, there was something very intensely authoritarian about how COVID was, you know, became this pretext for special powers and new powers.
Lot was happening under the cloak of the health interventions, but it was quite obvious opportunities were presenting themselves for states to go the authoritarian route. Were there any incidents that stand out for you from your conversation, or particular countries where this was like particularly salient?
Perhaps one of the most striking cases is the United States upholding new kind of border restrictions. So Title 42, so-called Title 42 at the US border, which basically meant that it was like immediate expulsion for anyone trying to cross the US-Mexico border. You know, so the right to asylum was effectively suspended. Now, the World Health Organization did not mandate for countries to shut down borders. This is a point that was made in my interview with Hersha Walia in April this year. She's a, you know, she's an activist and writer based in Canada. And, you know, as she points out, the WHO did not mandate for countries to shut down borders, but over 100 countries did try to shut down their borders, particularly to asylum seekers and refugees. At the same time, the same countries were exploiting migrant workers to do the so-called essential work, you know, in farms and hospitals and so on. So there's a kind of double standard there. You know, the border became a way to provide cheap labor in a context where more privileged people were being enabled to stay at home and not have to put themselves at risk by going to work, you know. And deportations continued through the pandemic. You know, like at one point, a quarter of the COVID cases in Honduras and Guatemala were basically cases that had resulted from the United States deporting people to those countries, right? Oh, so the ambiguities around the border were really striking, and the violations of rights came out very clearly in that discussion with Hersha Walia and with the earlier one with Edda Sayhan.
So the pandemic essentially provided an opportunity for states, perhaps even not even the authoritarian regimes, right? The ones that considered themselves democratic still had sort of increase in security, increase in a focus on policing and that kind of thing. But it wasn't only states that took this opportunity, right? We've got some other big players that got involved.
Yeah. So the big thing that I hadn't really anticipated would come out in these interviews, and which points in a different direction from what the analogy with the war on terror would have predicted, is just the way that the kind of international response to COVID was so organized through the power of the big drug companies. So this was something that came out in three or four of the interviews I did. Harris Gleckman, who I interviewed in June 2022. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Governance and Sustainability at the University of Massachusetts Boston, and previously worked at the UN. And you know, he made this point that I think is powerful, which is, so obviously something like COVID, you need an international response. It's not going to be something that can be just dealt with at the level of national government. So you need an international response. And the obvious candidate for the body that would coordinate that would be the World Health Organization, you know, part of the United Nations. And also it's, I mean, I hadn't heard about this, but there's an organization called the World Health Assembly, which has representatives from all the UN member countries and is a body to which the WHO is accountable to national governments, right? And so in that sense, it has, you know, an imperfect, but some kind of channel of accountability to the peoples of the world. But the WHO was completely marginal in the international response to COVID. So what you have instead is what are called multi-stakeholder bodies. These are not part of the UN. They're essentially just bodies that are set up by corporations, which masquerade as being motivated and organized by not just simply the bottom line of drug companies, but, you know, some kind of concern for equity in, for example, the distribution of vaccines, the distribution of the medical supplies that are needed to deal with COVID. And so they provide a kind of buffer against criticism of the drug companies, which, of course,
in the sense that it's not just the drug companies acting by themselves for their profit motive, but they're working with the United Nations, so it must be above board.
Yeah, and these aren't actually organizations that are part of the UN, but they come across like they are, you know, bodies where various global stakeholders can collectively work together to shape a global response, right? And so they would have representatives from the big drug companies. They'd also have representatives from perhaps something like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who, you know, I mean, that was a key actor in establishing these multi-stakeholder bodies. So, you know, for example, one of these bodies is called COVAX. You know, if you wanted to criticize drug companies to say, well, why are you making all this money from selling vaccines? Surely these vaccines should be made available to whoever needs them based on a health argument rather than a profit motive. Then, you know, the drug companies would point to COVAX and say, well, yes, we're making a certain number of vaccines available to this body called COVAX. And COVAX is then organizing the distribution of these vaccines to different parts of the world that wouldn't otherwise be able to afford to buy the vaccines. And so, you know, it would give us a sense that they're being socially responsible as corporations, right? That they can point to their involvement in these bodies. But these multi-stakeholder bodies aren't accountable. They don't operate on the basis of assessing the healthcare needs of the world and then distributing vaccines in that way. At the beginning of 2020, the WHO recommended that the distribution of vaccines around the world, once vaccines become available, should operate according to the principle that you get those vaccines to everyone around the world who's a healthcare worker, first and foremost. They're the people we need to be healthy, and they're the people, you know, highly at risk. So the healthcare workers in Mozambique should get vaccinated at the same time that the healthcare worker in Denmark or the United States or a richer country does. Once all the healthcare workers of the world are vaccinated, we then move on to the next risk groups around the world, elderly people, et cetera, right?
Which now, would make a lot of sense.
Which makes a lot of sense, right? And that, and that, of course, is not what happened. What you saw instead is, you know, people in Europe and the United States and the rich countries getting vaccinated four times over before those vaccines reached, you know, the poorer countries of the world in the global south. So essentially the drug companies organized for distribution of vaccines for profit, right? I mean, it was a market-based arrangement. And they were able to make huge profits. And this is the thing that, you know, another striking thing here is how the kind of economics of their business is organized.
That's something that stood out for me throughout this whole pandemic, right? Like, if this is such a huge emergency for the global population, for the human race, essentially, why not just give out the recipe and have countries make their own vaccines if they have the capacity? Or why not ramp up the production across with those countries that are able to produce high levels of a vaccine? Why hold on to the intellectual property and still try to make a profit out of it. It seems to me that the profit motive still got in the way.
Well, absolutely. And I think this is something that really came out in my conversation with Mirga Kamalyani, who's a co-leader of the policy group of an organization called the People's Vaccine Alliance. And she's been a health advisor with NGOs and governments around the world. She pointed out that we have a system for developing vaccines where public money from governments is given to drug companies to fund their research on developing vaccines. So, for example, mm-hmm. Moderna received $10 billion in government funding to develop their COVID-19 vaccine. Plus, governments pay the drug companies money in advance to kind of lock in sales of the, mm-hmm. of the vaccine even before it's been developed. And those aren't dependent on the success of the vaccine. So with those kind of arrangements, the drug companies are basically operating risk-free because taxpayers have subsidized the development and they're paying in advance for the vaccine. So there's zero risk for the
company. They make money either way.
Right? They're making money either way. And then once the vaccine's developed, health authorities are buying the vaccine with public money. So you've got public money being used every part of the process. You know, Moderna made 66% net profit on its vaccine, right? And the public takes the risk of investing in that development, right? And you know, drug companies would say that their huge profits are needed to fund the research.
Yeah.
But they don't provide any accounting for what the research costs of a drug development is. It's incredibly secretive. And so clearly they are this is not the kind of idea, the kind of, you know, romantic idea of entrepreneurial business kind of developing new ideas and new products in this kind of buccaneering risky way and then being tested by the free market as to whether or not those will be successful. The entire thing is subsidized by public money. Mm-hmm. So and you know, when Oxford University developed the vaccine, AstraZeneca ended up owning as its own product. So that was developed by Oxford University scientists, right? Again, so not in a private company, but in a higher education setting. Uh-huh. This was, again, another thing that Mirga Kamalyani talked about. So when that vaccine was ready to be distributed, Oxford University wanted to make it available basically as a free of charge or a very low cost vaccine around the world, because, you know, that actually is a tradition in a kind of older tradition in vaccine development, right? That mm-hmm. these things aren't seen as a thing for scientists or drug companies to get rich from, but a contribution to the advancement of humanity and you know, public healthcare. And that was the thinking of the Oxford University people who were looking at this after, you know, once they'd produced their vaccine. And it was actually Bill Gates who lobbied Oxford University to say, no, this needs to be sold to a drug company. Wow. And you need to deal with a drug company so it becomes intellectual property. And that's in the end what happened. I mean, Bill Gates and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have been central players in ensuring that no precedent is set in the context of COVID for commercially valuable products to break the normal market-based rules on how, you know, what's called intellectual property is distributed, right? So, and obviously Bill Gates' fortune comes from exploiting intellectual property, right? So, you know, software is also intellectual property, just like vaccines, right? And so—
high incentive to keep the status quo.
right. And it's, you know, it's incredible to me that has just not been reported on, or, you mean, to me, that should be a front page story of the New York Times. It's an incredible story, right? And what are the consequences of that, right? The consequences of that are that vaccines have been unevenly distributed around the world because most of the people in the world who needed to be vaccinated could not get it in time because it became a matter of which countries could afford it. Vaccines that were allocated to be made available to parts of Africa were actually set aside to be used for the third or fourth booster shots for people in Europe, right? When Europe when the Boris Johnson government suddenly decided it needed another round of booster shots, it basically managed to find a clause in the deal that I think Moderna had done with COVAX, this multi-stakeholder body, so that vaccines that were actually meant to be set aside to be used in sub-Saharan Africa were then brought and diverted to be used in Britain, right? So, wow. You know, I mean, three of my cousins in India died of COVID in 2021. They would have survived if they'd been vaccinated, you know, and that's true of millions of people. I mean, Moga Kamoyani, you know, she pointed out that 12 million people died of HIV through exactly the same process. They died because there was medication that could have saved their lives, but it was not made available to them because of the global regime of intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the numbers of people that died unnecessarily for affordability reasons during the COVID period will also be in the millions, right? We haven't been able to estimate that number yet, but it will be in the millions, right? And that's,
the actual real life consequence of this
Right. And this is, I mean, that's the headline that should be on the front page of the New York Times, right? Bill Gates' lobbying probably led to the death of millions of people unnecessarily, right?
Yeah.
To uphold this intellectual property regime.
Speaking of Bill Gates and intellectual property and stuff, we also saw like a huge involvement of other big corporations, right? Like the big tech companies. There was a whole conversation about COVID being sort of an opportunity to show how this new modern technology can help us in public health outcomes, but it doesn't seem to have really changed much, or at least not positively.
Right. And this is one of the things that came out in a really interesting way in the interview I did with Seda Gürses in May 2022. And Seda is a critical computer scientist who works at the University of Delft. So you remember that at some point in 2020, you might have noticed if you had an iPhone or an Android phone that you could get notices on the phone telling you that you'd been in contact with someone who tested positive for COVID, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a technology that was kind of introduced by Apple and Google into the very operating system of cell phones and relied on the Bluetooth technology in those phones to kind of figure out when someone had been in contact with someone else who tested positive, right? Now, what's striking, and this is, you know, Seda kind of laid out this whole process of how that came about. And it, you know, it's striking that when government started to want to introduce a system of contact tracing, particularly in Europe, they basically had no choice but to work through the cloud and mobile device infrastructure that these companies like Apple and Google had been building up since the 1990s. So in order to access their own citizens, this kind of cloud and cell phone infrastructure became the means to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a kind of opening for these tech companies to become central players in public healthcare systems, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they were doing this for free. You know, the kind of classic model of privatization is, you know, some public health service that's provided by government, you know, a private company comes along and pitches that it can do this service in the private sector, and taxpayers' money is then diverted from the public sector to pay for a private company to provide this service, right? And and the private company generates profit that way, right? That's
supposedly
the kind of classic.
Works more efficiently than the
exactly, right? So we know that story, right? That's been the story for some years, right? But this is something very different because Apple and Google aren't charging governments to introduce this infrastructure. They are providing it for free. And what they get in return is, it is not, you know, immediate profit, but is political influence and power and access to sit at the table when big decisions are made about how public healthcare infrastructure is developed, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they wanted.
So COVID was like their foot in the door, essentially.
It was their foot in the door to have a seat at that table of global healthcare governance, right? Apple and Google understand that the possibilities of how they can make profits from being involved in public healthcare in the future are, you know, that there's all kinds of myriad ways that might play out 10 mm-hmm. years from now, 20 years from now. But what they need now is to be able to be considered the key partners for government in mm-hmm. In public healthcare, which is what they were able to establish through this move during COVID. And it speaks to, you know, I think what it illustrates, and this is the point that Seda just, you know, really brought out in a way that I hadn't understood before, was it just illustrates how, you know, the sort of four or five big tech corporations based in the US, along with a few others in China, have basically been able to kind of create this infrastructure of our lives with cloud computing and the connected cell phones, that basically now that's the way that we now imagine what any kind of organization for public administration or any kind of logistical function, we imagine it as basically a cloud-based service, right? And so we don't think about the implications of that in terms of, you know, the power of big tech that we've handed over there, and mm-hmm. and the loss of control over our ability to democratically design our public life, our public bodies, our public administrations, and our visions of what they might be for. We've kind of basically outsourced that to the tech corporations, right? And while certain kind of ethical principles are being articulated, and, you know, ideas of protecting privacy were involved in that use of cell phones to do contact tracing, you know, those principles are suspended in the global south, right? So mm-hmm. the same technology.
So it's also a form of collecting data about the global population, essentially.
Absolutely. It becomes a way of doing surveillance, because those kind of rules of privacy are not, you know, they're not rolled out in the same way when it comes to how these technologies are deployed in, you know, Kenya. Seda talked about Kenya being a kind of testing ground for all kinds of experimentation by big tech.
And the governments don't have the access to these companies' data sets. They don't have access to essentially the black box of what happens in the computers. And they have to ask the companies if they need any information about their own populations, essentially.
Exactly. I mean, those data sets, they're of incredible value for, obviously they're of incredible commercial value, because mm-hmm. Healthcare is a business. And imagine the possibilities for scientific research that you can have with that data, right? So the Apple and Google become the kind of gateway for anyone who wants to do scientific research on all of that data of people's movements and how COVID interacted with that, you know? So it's beyond immediate commercial interests, and it's mm-hmm. about establishing something that is a future infrastructure that mm-hmm. but it's happening without us really noticing it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this all of this kind of goes down to, I guess, the initial questions you had, right? The idea of power, the idea of being able to influence human behavior in a particular way, and to continue making money, essentially. You spoke also about, like, how there was a difference in how policies were applied to certain people based on their race, based on their location, based on particular traits that they may have. Could you speak a little bit about that, the racialization that came with all of this, and any other related concerns in that area?
Yeah, so one of the things coming into this that I was thinking about was the question of processes of racialization, right? And you know, because that is something that we had, of course, seen in the war on terror with anti-Muslim racism. And you know, one of the interviews I did was with Deepa Kumar, who's a professor mm-hmm. of media studies at Rutgers University, and talked about how, you know, in the war on terror, there was this constructed association of Islam with terrorism. And she had looked in detail at the way that terrorism and Islam were talked about in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, and shows that, you know, this association of Islam and terrorism, which feels so familiar in the last couple of decades, you know, feels almost natural, as it were. It wasn't something that had always been there, and it wasn't something mm-hmm. that just kind of spontaneously sprung up after 9/11, but it was generated gradually over a number of decades, going through a number mm-hmm. of forms until it gets to that point more recently, right, where it feels mm-hmm. where it feels like it's always been there. So that, I mean, I think that's an important point because it tells you that this is a historical process, right? Mm-hmm. And so with COVID, I think on the one hand, we saw how there were attempts to kind of racialize the origins of COVID, right? And to tell mm-hmm. a story about COVID as originating in a particular culture or particular ethnic group or being spread more by a particular group. So you know, in India, there was all kinds of attempts to mobilize the idea that Muslims were more responsible for spreading COVID. In the United States, you saw the question of COVID interact with a kind of pre-existing political project of demonizing China and Chinese Americans. So, you know, we've seen an increasing movement in Washington, D.C., a bipartisan movement, really, to identify China as no longer a kind of partner in some kind of project of globalization, but as a threat to U.S. hegemony. And as, you know, the interview I did with Toby Tchao in August 2022, he's the founding director of Justice is Global. And, you know, he talked about how, you know, the association of the pandemic with China became this kind of catalyst for anti-Chinese sentiment that kind of intensified something that was already there. And the root cause of it isn't COVID. The root cause of it is really that because you've got this kind of increasingly hostile foreign policy towards China, you get an increasingly hostile domestic policy towards people perceived to be Asian, right? And so it kind of has this consequence on the ground within the United States for Asian Americans. So that's one of the ways that this kind of question of racialization interacted with COVID. But, you know, across everywhere, really, you saw racialized groups being kind of singled out by, you know, if you introduce a curfew and you ask your police officers to enforce a curfew, which is something that happened in most places, then the pre-existing patterns of racism in those police forces are going to play out with targeting, right? And in France, you saw that very clearly with Black people and Arab people being heavily assaulted in the pretext of imposing a curfew. In India, you know, I interviewed Sulakshana Nandi in July 2022, and she's the co-chair of the Global Steering Council of the People's Health Movement in India. And, you know, she pointed out that, you know, in India, you saw this very authoritarian and very restrictive and badly planned kind of lockdown policy that was introduced nationwide in March 2020 with just 4 hours notice. It was really a kind of humanitarian crisis as, you know, you saw millions of migrant workers who were suddenly forced to trek home. And because they were forced to leave home, because I mean they're leaving the cities to go back to villages by and large. And I mean they were forced to do that because they were no longer employed in people's homes and so on. And so having to trek home to survive, they were effectively violating the nationwide lockdown. And so then they were targeted again by the police. And of course, you know, the general structures of inequality and discrimination in India that would, you know, particularly affect precarious workers that would operate on the basis of caste or basis of gender. That was something that led to particular forms of police violence against those groups, but also affected the death toll of COVID, right? Was disproportionately targeted on those groups because of their unequal access to healthcare resources and so on, right? Yeah. You see those patterns everywhere from, you know, from the United States, where the rates of illness and death from COVID were higher for racialized groups than, you know, than for white people and so on, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a general pattern we saw around the world.
Yeah. So the image I get is, you know, COVID came through and sort of enhanced, heightened, like generally increased existing patterns of inequality, of oppression. It didn't turn out to be the revolutionary moment that I think many people thought it would be, because it's such a big problem. It's such a huge demand for global action. So everyone's going to come together and finally, you know, the human race unites to solve all these problems. That's not how it panned out, and we find ourselves essentially here. If I may ask, where's here, and what comes next?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one thing to say here is, you know, in January this year, I interviewed Jomo Kwame Sundaram, who is a visiting senior fellow at the Khazanah Research Institute in Malaysia. And, you know, he's a leading economist, used to work for the United Nations. And he pointed out that, you know, because of the unequal vaccine distribution around the world, countries in the global south were unable to come out of the pandemic as quickly because of the need for lockdowns and so on that lasted longer than in richer countries. And so that then has profound economic consequences, right? Because obviously you have the you know, lockdown means there's a profound economic impact. Mm-hmm. And that then is coming, you know, the economic growth was already slowing in the global south before the pandemic. And now with, in particular, the raising of interest rates in the US on the dollar, that is putting pressure on exchange rates for countries in the global south, which is, again, slowing down growth. At the same time, the International Monetary Fund, which had kind of taken, you know, I think Jomo called it an unusually ambiguous attitude during the pandemic, where they did seem to some extent to advocate for the need for kind of relief for poorer countries. But now they've shifted back to, you know, the more standard policy from the IMF of, you know, austerity, the need to avoid inflation, and so on. And so we're looking at another period of a kind of debt crisis in the global south. We've seen that already, in particular in, you know, in Sri Lanka and Pakistan. And the way that he talks about that is, you know, we're no longer looking at what we used to call a Washington consensus, you know, from the 1980s, because now there are other funding sources apart from the IMF and the World Bank. You know, there's all kinds of multilateral development banks. Mm-hmm. He points to the role of the Bank of International Settlements, the role of the OECD, the G7, the G20. And so what he calls it the Davos consensus. In other words, it's no longer just centered on Washington, D.C., but on a more kind of globally dispersed kind of elite. But nevertheless, the consequences look very much like they would have done in the 1980s, as I say, with a looming debt crisis. So that's one part of this. But I think the kind of thinking forward from here, you know, I think the interview I did with Femi Taiwo in November 2021 is useful for kind of conceptualizing what we've experienced and how to think about this going forward. So Femi Taiwo is an assistant professor of philosophy at Georgetown University in the United States. And he talked about how the left needs to revive a kind of our own kind of language of security, right? Like the question of security feels like it's something that is a right-wing topic, a conservative topic. Mm-hmm. It feels like something that's about fear, about threats that we need to protect ourselves from. But he points out that, you know, we have another tradition of thinking about security that comes through the left, which is thinking about security as things like access to food and water and shelter, right? The things we need to be self-sufficient. And really, we need to distinguish between what we might call antagonistic security and collaborative security, right? So antagonistic security is that idea of security as needing to control threats to us through some kind of coercive violence, making someone else less secure in order for us to be or feel more secure. You know, that's the kind of arms industry view of security or the police view of security. And it obviously you can see how it tends towards demonizing racialized groups, migrants, and so on.
It's security from a threat. So somebody's got to be the threat.
Right. Exactly. But there's also collaborative security, which is about seeing that the very thing that makes me safe is also what makes you safe, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, something like a vaccine for COVID, if you take a vaccine, it helps protect me. And if I take the vaccine, it helps protect you. Our security is bound up in each other, right? So it's actually in my interest as someone living in the United States for, you know, the person living in sub-Saharan Africa to be vaccinated. Mm-hmm. Right. That's what we lose sight of when we give the language of security to conservatives and they turn it into simply a question of antagonistic security, because there's also that sense of collaborative security. Right. It gets us away from that scarcity mindset around security. Right. And that's the thing that, you know, you can see the sort of elements of that bubbling up from some of the kind of grassroots response to COVID, right? The people who were talking about mutual aid were kind of thinking along those lines. The people, you know, in the United States in 2020, the summer of 2020 was, you know, 15 million people on the streets talking about wanting to defund the police because of racist police violence, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests, right? So that sense of, you know, we don't secure ourselves by putting more and more money into funding police officers. We make ourselves secure by doing things like proper public healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. Like healthcare that isn't controlled by big drug companies, but is based on identifying regular people's healthcare needs and understanding that that is a collaborative thing, right? Making other people healthy makes me healthy, right? That's what was kind of bubbling up, I think, maybe a little bit below the radar of the mainstream through the COVID period. But there were that kind of thinking was there, I think, around the world in various ways. Yeah. And that's what, you know, we need to build on going forward.
Yeah, we did see it, right? Like community kitchens coming up when things were bad. A lot of things went wrong, but there was some sort of way in which people really came together and took care of each other. And if we could scale that up globally, that would be really great, I think.
Right. And it's about making the leap from, you know, from kind of performing a kind of recognition for the work that nurses were doing during COVID, to actually say
caring for them at 8 o'clock.
Right. So actually moving on to saying, well, what is, you know, how do we have nurses actually able to live dignified lives? You know, how do we organize to strengthen nurses' unions, and how do we integrate that kind of work into a broader vision for, you know, for what public healthcare might look like? Yeah. One that doesn't depend on migrant cheap labor to make it work. This was a point I think that Ada Sahan made. You know, like we put more people in prisons during COVID, right? Wow. We put immigrants in detention centers during COVID, you know, like, and we were spreading COVID that way, right? And yet we were quite stingy about doing things like mass testing. She says we did mass incarceration instead of mass testing.
Which worked against trying to stop COVID from spreading. And
Right. Exactly. Right.
So easier for people.
You know, so the alternative that we didn't do enough of, but you know, sometimes we were able to, but didn't do enough of it, you know, is to enable mass testing, proper public health care, you know, effective contact tracing, accurate public information, you know, financial support to enable people to remain at home, not shutting down borders. You know, these kinds of things were the things that organizations like the WHO were recommending. You know, they were able to make those recommendations based on long established and well-known public healthcare norms, right? We need to take back healthcare from the corporations and return to, or in some places, implement for the first time that kind of public healthcare regime. And we need it to be global, because this is not going to be the last time that we see something like this. And the principles that we need to apply, those collaborationist security principles that we need to apply for dealing with something like a pandemic, are also exactly the same principles that we need to apply to deal with something like climate crisis. Mm-hmm. So these questions are going to be with us for the foreseeable future.
Wow. Oh, thanks, Arun. I mean, this has been very wide ranging, and we've touched on so many different parts of your work with these interviews over the last couple of years. Is there anything in particular that didn't come up just now that you'd like to add in finishing?
Maybe I would like to share the slogan that Hersha Walia offered us in her interview. She said, no banks, no bombs, no borders, no bosses. Why would we fight for anything less than the freedom of all people?
Wow. No banks, no borders.
No bombs.
No bombs. Wow. Thank you so much. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This has been a conversation with TNI associate Arun Kundlani. Arun was reflecting on a series of conversations that he had with multiple experts to try and understand the long-term impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic and to seek alternative ways we can respond to any future crisis. Arun has recently written a new book called What is Anti-Racism? and why it means anti-capitalism. I highly recommend that you check it out. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from, and to please write us a review, which can only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and be sure to tune in next time.